On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. As I was saying to my guest, writer-director Paul Feig, the best-dressed man behind the camera.
Oh, go on.
I will go on.
As you might learn
from
the
recent Wall Street Journal. He's also a writer. He was here first for his autobiography, Super Stud.
Yes.
Gosh, that's the first time you were here.
That's crazy.
In fact, the first time I met you, when you were at your office in Burbank in the 90s, you were wearing a T-shirt and jeans.
We don't talk about those days,
what days?
Friend.
That's the 20th century. That doesn't exist anymore.
That's right, really.
In fact, you have to go back to the 20th century to find a little movie called Ghostbusters. Which you just happened to remake.
Before, nice
of course, he's up. He was like, I've done this for a couple of years now. Paul was last here for his film, Bridesmaids. Of course, he's in the interim. He's made The Heat and Spy, and it's a thrill to have him here. And
thank you, Elvis. I always love seeing you. You are literally one of my favorite people on the planet.
Well, thank you.
It's true.
Well, that's an honor to have you say that, because I guess I was thinking about this and watching a bunch of stuff, and what's happened so often in your work, and it interestingly lends itself to Ghostbusters, is the idea of the overachiever and the person who can't see, the person who represents common sense. These two poles are so often represented in the things that you, even going back to your fiction, these two ideals are kind of represented. And I wonder if you thought, as you were approached to do Ghostbusters, that this thing that you do as a writer lends itself to that franchise.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I've been approached to do a sequel script that they had. Ivan had called me when I was shooting.
Ivan Reitman, the director of the original.
Exactly. When I was shooting Spy in Budapest. If I may backtrack, I have a weird history with this, because when I was co-EP on The Office back in 2008, two of the writers, Lee and Gene, got asked to write Ghostbusters 3. And at that point, I was really deep in movie jail. And I remember just thinking, like, oh, would there ever be a point in my career where, like, somebody would ask me to do this movie? And it's like, no, it would never happen. So then flash forward, and I get the call, which was so great. But at that point, you know, things had been going a little better with the movie career, and you're so afraid of going back into movie jail that I was like, I'm not touching Ghostbusters. You know, but they had this script that was a sequel script. And I read it, and I thought it was really fun, but we're coming into a world that had already seen two giant ghost attacks. The Ghostbusters had existed. They'd been forgotten. And then, you know, here's this new team that needs to be trained by the old team. And so what I didn't like is kind of like, well, here's your technology, and you're in a world where everybody knows these things happen, so now you're going to help them out. To me, I went like, I don't know. I want to tell a story about people who other people think are crazy and underachievers and you know, undervalued, who then have to save the day because they have this strong faith in something nobody else believes in. And so it felt better to, like, let's do it, reboot it. So now we're in a world like ours that's never really seen a ghost attack, other than you see these shows, you know, on, you know, ghost hunters and those, and you go like, are they crazy? Are they charlatans? You know, so into this world, our world, if suddenly paranormal activity really started happening, that's interesting to me, of like, who are the people who've dedicated their lives to this, who everyone else thinks is nuts, and then they end up, you know, winning the day.
Yeah, but even with that, though, I mean, still, we go to Freaks and Geeks, and we go to the movies you've written. Even in your fiction, that there are two poles. They're split between two people. I wonder if you unite these halves, if they're you. Mm. The overachiever, the person who's really intent on proving him or herself, mostly, in ways that people don't believe. We can go back to Bridesmaids, where she was an accomplished baker who couldn't get anybody to literally buy her product.
Yeah.
And here, Kristen Wiig is a character who's at the forefront of a certain kind of science that she can't get people to understand, but she's really committed to it.
Yeah.
And then the other half, if you will, is Melissa McCarthy, who's kind of like all instinct and all kind of just throwing caution to the wind. And because I just find it so fascinating that these poles exist in your work so often.
Well, I think it all reflects on the theme I always love, which is trying to find legitimacy, trying to find your place in the world. And this, to me, when I put this, you know, story together with Katie Dippold, it was very much about seeking legitimacy and about belief and faith. You know, and so you've got Melissa's character who has always believed in this, but she's never had proof of it. Then you've got Kristen's character who...
And who's been traumatized by it as a kid. I mean, there's, well, yeah, there's the emotional backstory.
Yeah, yeah, with Kristen, because she actually saw this ghost that appeared in her room every night for a year, and everybody thought she was crazy. The parents put her in therapy. She was called Ghost Girl. You know, it was like the worst thing could have happened to her. Nobody believed her except for her friend Abby, played by Melissa, who had never actually seen a ghost, but who believes so strongly that she's the one that believed her. And the idea that... these two people find this, you know, find this support group and how they bond together. And it's only as time goes on and they're still being called crazy by everybody that Kristen finally says, I can't take this anymore. I was put in therapy for this, for something I saw I know is real. I'm just going to separate from it. And the fact that she then comes back to try to get this book taken down that Melissa's character has put online that they wrote together about ghosts and ends up seeing a ghost for real. And has tangible proof once again that what she saw is not fake, and she actually gets it on videotape, and yet everybody still thinks they're crazy because it's today and you can do anything on tape and fake anything. And I just like that theme of, like, how much do you need to still have people go, you're right, we were wrong, you know, and that's a very powerful thing. And to me, that was really the theme of this.
Well, for your protagonists, though, and I'm glad you even brought up I Am David, because at some point for all these protagonists, the past plays a key part in their lives. They can't let go of the past.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's just how my life runs. I think that's how most people's lives run. If you think, you know, the reason therapy exists is to get you over things that happened before. You know, it just, for me, I get to do therapy via the books and TV shows and movies that I do.
And what you like to do is you like the idea of going from the dramatic to the broad.
Yeah.
Often in the same scene.
Yeah. Yeah, I love high and low. I'm very I'm not, back when we were doing Freaks and Geeks, I was people thought it was so classy. And it's like, look at Freaks and Geeks has a fart joke in literally every episode. I hate to inform everybody. But I like that because that's life though. I mean, you can hang around with the you know, the smartest people, and if, you know, somebody burps or something, everybody cracks up. You know, it's or even conversation will just go, you know, to weird kind of places because we just need to laugh. And that's what I love about doing comedy, is to, like, trying to find what's the real thing for it.
It's the treatment. We're talking high and low with former Detroiter Paul Feig, Detroiter made good. If you can see this suit, you know it's not from Lewis the Hatter. That's another Detroit joke.
Nicely.
Thank you. His new film is the director and co-writer is the reboot of Ghostbusters. And it's interesting, too, because it's, again, it goes back to this thing about not being able to let go of the past, which is something that doesn't happen very often in a movie. Usually it's like a specific trauma that somebody has to get over. But for you, these characters are as much rooted in their pasts as they are in their presents. And,
yeah,
and I just think that's a really interesting thing because it feels almost like a literary thing rather than a film thing to me.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, because my take on the world is everybody is that way. That's what people do. You can't, it's just some people just deny it.
But you know, in movies, usually there's one character who'll talk about it.
Yeah.
And the movie revolves around that.
Yeah.
But your films, everybody is kind of rooted to the past.
Well, you know what it is? Because I liked doing things about flawed characters, you know, who are kind of underdogs and struggling to find their place in the world. And I think anybody who's like that, which I think is most of us, you drag this anchor around, which is your past and the bad things that happened to you in the past, and whether they were horrendous or whether they were just at pointed moments or whether they were even not that bad, to you they are terrible, to you they are formative, and they affect everything you do and every decision you make as you face the world. And that's what I like about our villain, is that this guy who's just like, you know, he's just been traumatized by being beaten up and bullied his whole life. So he's just moving towards this point where he's going to pass that on to everybody else, because that's scarier to me than, you know, the gods are upset and they're sending their minions back down. And that's when I took this on. It was less important to me personally to do sort of like a Zool Gozer type thing and go like, who's God's angry man who walks among us?
He could almost be Kristen's character had she not had this sort of,
yeah,
this core of optimism around her.
Yeah, no, I like you picked up on that, because that is that interesting thing. It's like, it's all how you deal with the past. You know, we see it on the internet. We see it in everybody, you know, these days, of like, who's hanging desperately onto the past. How do they hang on to it? They hang on to it in a really destructive way? Or do they go like, hey, let's, you know, that's my past, but now here's a new thing? And I'm talking so coded for things that have been going on in my life for 2 years. The internet's a wonderful place, everyone.
I keep hearing that. That's why I stay off of it. But
you're so smart.
But I mean, even this character who's sort of the villain, but not really, is rooted in the past. He works at this hotel that's basically a passport to New York's glamorous past, this place that has this history. And one of your characters, Leslie Jones, is a historian. Mm-hmm. I mean, so she's her fixation is the past and history. Yeah. And some even Kate McKinnon's character is in love with this music that she can't identify from the past, but she likes this 80s groove. Mm-hmm. So I just like that the past is, if you pardon the expression, so present in the way these characters live their lives. That made it feel actually, to me, one of the more, given the circumstance, one of the more real of your comedies. And I wonder if you felt like you had to do that so it was grounded in something, so when the fantastic stuff comes, it makes sense.
Well, I mean, it's a movie about ghosts, so literally it's like everybody's haunted by either physical presences from the past or by their actual past. And you know, again, I just think that's what kind of forms us all, and it can make us wonderful too. It just depends what parts of it you bring along, you know. And it's also, I don't know, this is an odd movie to make because it brought along such a giant package of nostalgia with it. And I've never had to deal with that before because everything I've done before this has been original.
Yeah,
and so I'm not complaining about it because there's actually something kind of great about doing something that everybody already is aware of, but then it brings a whole other, you know, load of kind of pressure.
Well, it's not just aware of, but people have an ownership of that material.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, like, in a way that I did not anticipate because I was like, how old was I? Probably, I mean, like 22 years old, I think, when I saw it. I was in film school or just getting out of film school, went and saw it with all my kind of comedy buddies because we were in love with Dan and Harold and Bill and didn't know much about it because in the days before the internet, you didn't know everything about a movie other than maybe one trailer and a poster. So we went and just kind of sat there and like, we're so blown away by it because we'd never seen a comedy like that with special effects and scope and stakes and all that. So it really meant a lot to us, but we also weren't 7, 8, 9 years old seeing that for the first time and then running around our neighborhoods playing Ghostbusters with our friends and drinking Ecto Cooler and all this other stuff, which actually that came later with the cartoons, but it became such a big part of people's childhood. So when it was brought to me, you know, I knew it was canon, but at the same time, it was also the thing like, oh, yeah, we all love this movie. It's so much fun. But I didn't realize it was literally a religion to some people. Then I had to go like, okay, well, just think about it. Like, what is in there that I love? And it was the idea of the underdog. This could be an underdog story. And it's one of the, I think it's one of the greatest ideas ever. The idea of funny people fighting the paranormal with technology. It's got everything I love. It's got science. It's got underdogs, you know, and it's got chance for scope and action. So it was really when you go, okay, if I can just kind of strip away the old one, leave the old one so that I thought it was actually more, it was much more reverent to not make a sequel because by doing that, I say, like, there's these two. These are over here. These are great. We're not touching those. We're just going to kind of take this, keep it under the umbrella of a Ghostbusters universe just because it is about funny people fighting the paranormal with technology, and then make it our own. And then I suddenly had creative energy. And then when I thought, okay, well, the original movie, why it was so great outside of the concept itself is because that cast at that time were the best, funniest people. I mean, even, you know, Sigourney Weaver coming off of, you know, Aliens, is like everybody was great, and Moranis, and oh my God, everybody. And so I said, I got to do that. If I can get a dream team of the greatest, funniest, best people working now, then I have energy for that. And then the minute I thought, well, if I get the funny women that I know, then my brain exploded. And even my wife, when I came home and said I was thinking about it, she was like, don't do it. Don't do it. What, are you crazy? But then when I told her the idea, when she read the first draft of the script, she was like, I get why you want to do this. And then history will judge whether it was a good idea or not.
Wow. We're talking self-justification with our old friend Paul Feig. He's the director of the new Ghostbusters film. We're going to take a break. I'm going to have a bite of my Ghostbusters Twinkie.
Oh, yes.
It's the treatment. There's more to come.
I hope you like sugar.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
And Welcome back. I'm getting sugar, green slime from between my teeth. It's the treatment. I'm talking with our old friend Paul Feig. He's the director of the new Ghostbusters film. I have to say, as a person of color who's been pilloried my share of times on the internet, mm-hmm. the kind of stuff that this movie has received, particularly with Leslie Jones, I just find to be the most appalling behavior I can imagine.
It's horrendous. You know, I've had a great 8-year relationship with the internet, starting back in 2008, for 6 years it was just like the most loving, wonderful, supportive thing, because it was all, you know, fans of Freaks and Geeks and Bridesmaids and of my other two movies. And, you know, occasionally somebody would say something kind of, you know, snarky or whatever, but you're like, okay, that's fine. So to the point where I would hear other people who were getting attacked and stuff, I go like, how does that happen? Because you kind of can see who they are, and it just didn't make sense to me. And then the day I announced this, it was actually the second day. The first day I announced that I was going to do this with all women, like, the feedback was just unbelievable. Everybody's so happy. And so I was like, oh, my love affair with the internet continues. And then the second day, it just went in the toilet and just blatant misogyny. I mean, ugly, ugly misogyny. And this was before I even announced who the actresses were. And then when I put up the tweet that had the four pictures of the ladies, you know, about a few months later, then, oh my God, then it got even worse. And it was attacks physical, you know, attacks the way they looked, who they were, race, all this stuff. But yeah, it was really when the movie came out and we did very well for our opening weekend. I think it was a little bit of, you know, they wanted to lash out because they were always predicting we were going to bomb, bomb, bomb. And I think it just kind of got them upset. But the fact that they would go after Leslie, I mean, some of the ugliest, ugliest racism I've seen ever, honestly. I mean, what a horrendous attack on her. And God bless her. It hurt her, but she fired back and made it a public thing, and it went public. And it's, I mean, I don't even want to give these people credit.
No,
but
let's not do that. But yes, no. Having seen some of this stuff, and it's just, it's interesting because it's almost, in a weird way, you think about the difference between eras, between the 80s, mm-hmm. where New York was this place, this basically just hadn't quite recovered yet. And a lot of Times Square was sort of still the Times Square you show in the movie. Mm-hmm. But they feel like there's a kind of, with that group of actors and this group of actors too, there's a kind of optimism that the movie's finally about, and have people respond that way. So they're missing the point of what the movies are.
Well, that was the thing, and it's funny because, you know, in the whole lead up to it, you know, everybody's got a million theories about what it's going to be and this and that, you know, and they all think they know what you're doing, and you're like, okay, you don't quite know what we're doing. But what's sad for me is, just as a comedy guy, my only goal with my movies is to, number one goal is to entertain people and let them have fun. And I really wanted this to be like an old-fashioned summer tent pole where you just go in and you just have fun. You forget your troubles for a couple of hours. And, you know, because it's an absurd situation, you know, fighting ghosts, you know, which is, I think, is cool. But, it's not like watching a war movie or something where, you know, there's enough kind of like, oh, that could happen kind of to it.
Yeah, because you even turn the battle sequence into a musical number. So you're really trying to sort of take the martial aspect mm-hmm. of these weaponized tools being used to fight ghosts out of it. I mean, you're really trying to, I think, in a really interesting philosophical way, sort of say this isn't about fighting.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, you know, both myself and my stunt coordinator, Walter Garcia, are just enormous Jackie Chan fans. Like, and I love that stuff because it's physical and it's always about a guy who has these amazing skills, but he's always in a panic. That's what's great about Jackie Chan movies, is he never looks confident.
And there's also the Charlie Chaplin influence, I'm trying to say. I mean, the influence of Chaplin on him understanding that it's more interesting and there's more of an emotional investment if the fighters aren't confident.
Yeah, no, totally. It's like Buster Keaton, all these things where, you're in over your head, because that's, again, that goes back to the underdogs thing of like, we all root for people who are in over their head. And even if an amazing skill set comes out of that, you know, it's, that's why I've never kind of responded to a lot of superhero movies and kind of action movies, because it is sort of like, here's the cool guys, you know, or whoever coming in and they're fighting confidently. And when they're superheroes, like, they know they can't be hurt. You know, that's what I love about this movie so much. And this concept is that these are real life superheroes. These are human beings, mortals, who can be hurt and cut and bones can be broken and all that, just like any of us. But they use their brains and their ingenuity to come up with this technology that they can harness to protect themselves and to battle these forces. But they are still human. So as an audience, you're still going like, ooh, you know, like, they can still be hurt, versus, you know, Superman gets punched through a building and he kind of shakes his head and he goes, oh, that hurt. And you're like, I think it's fun. I love to watch that stuff. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't know. Where's the line where I have to worry he's really going to get hurt? Because, like, the kryptonite always comes out, but it never seems to kill him. You know, it makes him uncomfortable. And I get that. But, you know, I've got shoes that make me uncomfortable, too.
But you're spending so much money on your shoes. This is the treatment. We're talking to a man who's got a Clark Kent joke in his movies, Paul Feig, director of Ghostbusters.
Right,
it's the treatment. I guess, though, this still takes me back. And I like the idea. It really, what you do, your bent as a writer, as a creator, really lends itself to using women, because so much of this, what you've done, again, we go with the Freaks and Geeks or your autobiography, is about looking for institutional recognition in mm-hmm. this way, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Kristen in Bridesmaids or Sandra Bullock in The Heat mm-hmm. or Melissa in Spy. They want to be recognized by these places that still are about what Toni Morrison would call the male gaze, you know, about that sort of thing about it's men who are taken seriously.
Right.
And when I heard you were doing that, I thought, well, of course it's perfect, because all the things that his compass points towards Magnetic North for are really suited for this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at my movies, they're all about shades of professional women. Because I just got so tired of watching women's movies moralize to women that you got to choose between your career or your happiness. All the women I know have careers. They're very happy in those careers. Some of them actually have a family, and they're happy in the family, too, and they balance the two things out. What an odd thing. But movies seemed for so long to say, you got to pick one. You got to pick one. You're going to be the ice queen at work, or you're going to be happy in your, you know, with your husband and your kids or whatever it is. And I hate that, because who is anybody to tell, you know, anybody that they can't have a career and can't be happy in their career? And so that's why I'm really drawn to stories about women who are trying to find their place in the world, trying to you know, live out this career. You know, what I loved about The Heat was it's about two women who are dedicated to their work and they're good at it in different various ways, even though they have foibles. But their problem is they can't find a like-minded friend. And that, I think, is a great theme. And I mean, one of the themes I hit over and over again in my movies, because I'm fascinated by it, is female friendship. Because, you know, I've watched my wife, you know, her relationships with her friends and how they fall apart sometimes, and how it's finding that perfect person who is never going to let you down and is not going to, you know, kind of surprise you with something at the last minute where suddenly they bail out, or, you know, I just find it fascinating. And, you know, and male friendship is cool too, but I've seen that portrayed a million times.
Yeah. I mean, just because the idea of the modern woman, you think about it, the presence that women played in the original Ghostbusters, it's basically only two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're these different, completely different poles. I mean, one is literally like the goddess who was ascended to the clouds again, taken there by evil.
Right.
And the other is the most earthbound person you could possibly find. I'm not going to give anything away about your movie. But anyway, that idea that the feminine experience is not limited to a handful of archetypes,
yeah,
but also just about the demands of professional life. And that idea, again, going back to the beginning of the conversation, of the overachiever or the person who's got a talent and who isn't recognized for that, that person who's almost all sort of thought, and the person who's like almost all physical. I mean, that idea of these and also playing these I don't want to say archetypes, but these roles for their seriousness, not just making them as broad as you possibly can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the problem is just Hollywood has denied women three-dimensionality on screen in general. And this is, you know, there's exceptions to that rule, definitely. But if you look at the majority of films, it is women in service of men. And a lot of times it's women fall into these archetypes that men are used to or want. It's either mom's mean, my girlfriend's mean, my wife won't let me hang out with my friends, I wish I had a girl who loves sports and would let me do whatever I want and love my friends and would, you know, would burp with me and all that. But, you know, so I just felt like I just got tired of watching that, because all the women I know are, believe it or not, three-dimensional characters, you know, who have personalities that are both flawed and great. You know, that's why I hate the term strong female characters, because that seems to imply we've got to get a woman she's perfect, or she's, you know, it doesn't make mistakes. It's like, I don't want to watch those people. I'm bored with those people. I don't like to watch movies about guys who are like that, and I don't want to watch women like that. I want to watch these funny, flawed, strong yet weak, yet, you know, a million different issues going on, because that's what we all have. And that's, I think, why I especially love funny women, because, you know, comedy has to be about flawed people who have these issues. Otherwise, they're just boring.
But even, I mean, I know we talked a number of times before about Cary Grant, who, the way Hitchcock used him, basically he used this perfect male specimen as the butt of the joke.
Yeah. You know, it's fun. You know, we have good old Chris Hemsworth in our movie. And we didn't even write him to be as dopey as it ended up being. It was more that he was just kind of a guy who wasn't into his job, who answered on Craigslist and just kind of like sitting there and not into it. But when I first sat down with Chris about possibly doing it, we had lunch, and just him in his Australian accent, there was something very, I love the sound of it, and he's also just a very funny guy.
He doesn't even get to use that accent very often in movies.
No, so that's the first thing I said, like, Chris, I want you to play this like yourself. Because also, you know, I like to do a lot of improv and ad-libbing in the movies, and I find when anybody's got a filter of having to, like, think about, okay, I got to stay on my accent here, they're not thinking like themselves, and then they have to, you know, they're not at their full powers. And so I was like, yeah, let's bring Chris, and he's a super funny guy. He'll do this. And just as we were, you know, the first scene we really shot of any substance was the interview scene where the girls are interviewing him. And it was like 5 hours of cross shooting, and just he started playing with them and they were playing with him. And it just, he started ad-libbing. And, you know, that whole thing about Mike Hat, he has a cat named Mike Hat, which is actually Mike Hat, Michael Hat. That came out of an improv. Like, I was just like, oh, you have, let's see if you want to have your cat come to work with you. But he's the one that suddenly went like, oh, no, he's not a cat, he's a dog. And, you know, suddenly Melissa and Kristen are looking at me like, did you write the joke? I'm like, no, Chris is like off on some chair. And it just got funnier and funnier. And it just became clear that this character was really funny if he played sort of dopey. And so we just kind of went with that.
You really like balancing all these things that in some ways seem contradictory, don't you? I mean, an emotional scene that's got a physical comedy topper in it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't want to be tied down to anything. Funny is funny to me. And, like, funny comes from contrast. And, you know, it goes back to my love of the Marx Brothers and all that. You know, when you're in a very staid thing, or the Three Stooges, you know, what's greater than, like, an uptight party, and in comes, you know, the guys are going to repair the piano, and suddenly, you know, everything falls apart.
Anybody call the plumbers?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What's better than that, you know? So I just think, if we're doing comedy, as long as you keep the tone consistent, this is the biggest problem with, you know, the thing you got to watch when you're directing a movie is you can't subvert the tone for a joke. You can see if you can push the bounds of that tone with a joke. But the minute you go, oh, this will just be funny, but it breaks the tone in a way that suddenly the audience goes like, oh, come on, why would he do that?
You're thrown out of the movie.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. And the minute they go, oh, come on, you're dead. It's over. You know, I still don't know if this was the right decision. I cut a dance scene out with Chris Hemsworth, and I still don't know, because literally I've just come from the sound mix where we're mixing the extended cut where we put it back in to where it would belong. I think it was fine. I don't know. All I know is that when we do these test screenings, it was in the third act. It was he comes down and he immobilizes the army and the cops by making them, possessing them and making them do a disco dance to You
and
Should
Be Dancing. And they're frozen in the pose in the movie.
Yeah. You just have the pose, which is the end of the dance. And it gets a big laugh when we do it the way it is in the movie, where he just freezes them. But it would get a huge response when we were doing the test screenings, but then the audience couldn't recover from it.
It's too big a moment, isn't it?
It was too big of a moment that then we had to stop and then go into the big time square fight, which was much more important to me because that's my cast.
That's your that's really your denouement. That's where you get to see also how they finally become the title.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. So it was just like this thing of like, okay. But it was the hardest decision I've ever had to make. And I'm glad at least now the extended cut that'll be on DVD, you can weigh it out. But it also allowed me to then take all that dance footage we had and use it in the end credits way longer than I would ever, you know, the one of the movies only 30 seconds long. Now we've got about 4.5 minutes of Chris and these amazing dancers portraying soldiers doing their thing.
What a time we must be, because he just made a 20th century reference, DVD. My guest is Paul Feig. His newest film is director is Ghostbusters. I can't thank you enough for making it.
The soundtrack is out on 8-track next week.
So. Oh, bless your heart.
Yeah,
I was going to get an e-cassette of it. I can't thank you enough for really making the time to do this, Paul. Thank you so much.
Oh, Elvis, you're the best, and I always love being on The Treatment.
Thank you so much. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Theo Mondo. The show is mixed by Kat Yor, is edited by Blake Bite, who's associate producer. I ain't afraid of no show. It's The Treatment.
Nice.
To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.